Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 109 of the Gunblog Variety Cast. How are you doing, Aaron?
I am doing great, Sean. Last week, I was a guest on the Polite Society podcast. I'm on episode 389, and we discussed Operation Blazing Sword, and it was a great interview. Had a great time talking to him. I hope they'll have me back.
And I got to listen to it. It was very, very good. Everybody should take a listen to that, episode 389. And if you don't want to listen to all 2 hours of the Polite Society podcast, take a look. They do have a segmented feed. You can just listen to the segments that you want to listen to. There are two segments that you are in.
Yeah, I'm in both guest segments. They liked me so much, they had me stick around for the second part.
Yeah, it was pretty good. One of the good ways to listen to the Polite Society podcast is to listen to the segmented feed, and I believe they put out the different segments one segment a day, so you can listen to one segment every day on your way to work. So, Gun Rights Policy Conference coming up. This episode here, episode 109, is going to come out on Sunday. Gun Rights Policy Conference is going to start Friday. That means that this is the last episode that's going to happen before GRPC starts. So, get out your pen and paper. At the end of this episode, we are going to give you a link. And if you write that link down, you're going to be able to watch the live stream. I've seen the names of some of the people that are going to be on that live stream. Names of people that I've never heard of before, and people that everyone has heard of before, giving all sorts of talks from here's the state of all the different states, to here's the state of the national gun rights fight, to here's how do you use old media to win the gun rights fight, to here's how you use the new media to win the gun rights fight. All of these different people are going to be talking, and if you can't make it to Tampa, which I understand a lot of you can't, you can watch the live stream in wonderful, I believe, 4K video.
Yeah, I think he said it was 720p.
Well, actually, I believe that the guys at Geeks, Gadgets, and Guns, and having listened to their podcast, are actually building a computer, designing it specifically so that they can run 4K video. But at the very least, it's HD video.
Absolutely. And they're going to be focusing on your beautiful pony shirts. The t-shirts have come in, and the embroidered polos are in the mail. You're going to look marvelous.
You had to bring me down, didn't you? Speaking of bringing me down, had the worst dog attack yet.
Oh, uh-oh. Are you okay? Is the dog okay?
Everybody's fine. I was out riding. It's my new 16-mile weekday ride. On Wednesday, I'm at the 8-mile mark. I'm going up a hill, so I'm going kind of slow. And all of a sudden, the biggest freaking dog comes screaming across this wide grass yard out of a garage. And you know how usually when you see a dog coming right for you, it's the biggest dog in the world. And then when you get a better look at it, it's not that big.
Right.
Yeah, well, it was that big. See, I wasn't going that fast and there was no way for me to just accelerate and get away from it. I was going uphill. I locked up the brakes. I put my left foot down and just basically stood up and like lifted the bike and turned 90 degrees. And I, you know, because it's a recumbent bike, that means my pedals are at the front. So I just put the pedals like straight at the dog. And I wish I had a recording of what I sounded like. I have no idea what I sounded like, but whatever I sounded like, it worked. It must have been pretty scary because the dog was, you know, somewhere between 80 and 90 pounds. And it came to a screaming halt in the middle of the road after coming all the way across, you know, his yard, came to a screeching halt right in the middle of the road, looking at my pedals and the, you know, the chainring and me, and went, I'm going to back up now, and backed up looking at me into his yard. And I'm, you know, get on your yard, you bad dog. You know, like command voice. You can probably still hear that my voice isn't quite right. That's kind of loud. And Unfortunately, I don't have the old heart rate monitor I used to have that would give me the instantaneous readout. And my phone, I swear, my phone is lying to me. My phone tells me that my maximum heart rate for that ride was 166. Baloney. My maximum heart rate for that ride had to be somewhere north of 200. Eventually, after I yelled at this dog for a while, the owner came out of the open garage. It was a woman, 30s, I guess, and she called the dogs, plural. The other dog didn't come off the yard, was smaller and not nearly as aggressive. And she called the dogs over, and they came over, and she petted them, and I said, you know, ma'am, your dog about gave me a heart attack. And she started laughing, but I wasn't entirely certain that it wasn't that nervous laughter, you know, that, you know, so, and I was still kind of scared.
Yeah, I had a similar situation, I don't know how many years ago. We were walking our dogs, and a German Shepherd came barreling out of, might have even been the garage, and came towards us, and I don't even remember what I said. I think it was, it might have been go home, go away, something like that. But I just turned and kind of roared at it. And I have never seen any dog, specifically a German Shepherd, just do that cartoon, throw on the brakes, skid to a halt. Fortunately, this neighbor was better than the person you had an encounter with. She immediately ran out, grabbed the dog by the collar, apologized, pulled the dog back in and said, you know, if I ever need a bodyguard, I'm getting you.
Yeah. I always say, get back in your yard, you bad dog. Because for some reason, pretty much everybody says that to their dog. Something about get back on your property, get back in your yard. Mm-hmm. I'll say basically the same thing.
And also, if anyone's listening, that's really good for a liability standpoint.
I guess. Actually, we kind of covered that in Handgun World Podcast. I'm going to be a guest on Handgun World, episode 386. That will come out about 12 hours before this podcast comes out. So episode 386, Handgun World, Bob Main and I talk about carrying a handgun on a bicycle.
Wow, surprisingly relevant.
Surprisingly relevant, because one of the things we talk about is how to deal with dogs on a bicycle. And one of the things I say is, don't try to shoot a dog. It's not going to work. It's really a bad plan. You're going to just skip the bullet off the pavement, go through somebody's wall, and you're going to shoot little Johnny in his crib, and you're going to go to jail. Even if you could get to the gun in time, well, just check it out. Episode 386, Handgun World Podcast. Find it on iTunes, probably a few other places. Other exciting news? We remember John as the LGBT person that I took to the range that I met through your organization, your organizational skills.
Absolutely.
With Operation Blazing Sword. Never would have met John any other way. There was no points where our lives would have intersected. I've looked, and honestly, there's no possible way that John and I would have intersected. Not at all. So we only would have met through Blazing Sword. Well, took John to the range, showed John how to shoot. A couple of days ago, John got his North Carolina concealed handgun permit. I said, well, you know what we got to do now? We got to have the ceremonial first carry. What are we going to do? Oh, well, how about let's go to this coffee shop? I'm like, coffee shop? That's kind of, well, no, seriously, there's a guy there who wears like one of those Moulin Labe hats and that'd be a great place. Considering
what a coffee hipster I know John to be, I'm surprised he went within 20 feet of a coffee shop.
I know nothing. I don't even like coffee. That's the funny part. I don't even like coffee. I'm like, I was going to go to Pelican Snowballs. That was my thought. Pelican Snowballs makes these like crush up some ice and it's like a snow cone thing. So we went, John carried concealed for the first time. It was awesome.
How was it?
Couldn't tell.
Okay. I just didn't know if he was nervous, if he had that
whole,
is everyone looking at me?
Nah. He did do the, well, you know, can you tell? Nah.
All right.
And the other thing is deer season opens in a month. I've got something lined up and hopefully this time I can find a deer that's dumb enough to walk in front of me. Every other time the deer have just sat in the trees and laughed at me. So maybe fourth time's the charm.
Maybe. Of course, with deer season coming up, you're going to need ammunition to feed your rifle. So thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com. Continuing her Gun Girl glamour tour, Beth just got back from Crimson Trace. She's going to tell us how using a laser will totally give away your position in a gunfight. Or, you know, not.
They say that there are always two sides to every story. And no matter what the topic, there is always good things and bad things to consider. This notion doesn't change in the case of using laser sights with self-defense handguns. Some shooters sing the praises of laser sights. Others are opposed to them and only use iron sights or night sights. But take into consideration these two very different examples. On one hand, I was working with a gentleman, an older gentleman who had a lot of experience with firearms, and he was actually going through a shooting qualification. One of the tasks was to shoot 5 rounds at a distance of 25 yards. The gun that he used that day was actually equipped with a laser in the grip. And at that distance, and with somewhat shaky hands from nerves, arthritis maybe, and quite possibly just from older age, that red dot was jumping all over his target. He found it terribly distracting, and he didn't score very well. However, when we taped over the laser and he gave it another go, the gentleman improved his score tremendously and was able to pass the test. So for him, in this particular scenario, the laser was a bit disruptive. Now, on the other hand, I was recently training a brand new shooter in basic pistol class. She was really struggling with sight alignment. The holes were spread all over the paper. It just really wasn't clicking with her, and she could not figure out what to do to improve her shots. So after some work and a little refinement, we were able to bring her grouping in a little bit tighter. But she was still shooting low. At least we had more of a pattern, so I let her try shooting a gun with laser sights. Her eyes got wide when she saw the dot dancing around way lower than she thought she was shooting. She was also very intrigued when she saw the beam drop lower after she pressed the trigger. It was kind of like the double aha moment. Since laser sights operate by projecting a visible beam of light directly onto a target, she was able to visually witness what we had been talking about, and she was able to fix both sight alignment and trigger manipulation. And for her, in this particular situation, the laser was a really useful training tool. So which is it? Is a laser on a gun good or bad? Useful or distracting? Well, honestly, it really depends on the person or the situation. But I recently had a chance to kind of talk to the source, if you will. I went to Portland, Oregon, and had a tour of the world headquarters of Crimson Trace. Now, Crimson Trace is probably the number one name that comes to mind when we think about lasers for a variety of different kinds of firearms. Going through the headquarters was kind of like watching an episode of How It's Made, so I got to see all the little nitty-gritty, intricate details, and I was really amazed. All the work that goes behind the scenes to produce these various elements and create a final product, it's really fascinating. It's also awesome that it's being made in the USA. And of course, it's always great to think of all the great uses for lasers, especially on handguns. Now, some might argue the downside or the possible negatives, such as the laser dot can be difficult, maybe hard to see in sunlight or bright environments. Maybe using a laser can make a shooter too dependent on a mechanical device that might not work properly. You know, just thinking about maintenance or thinking about batteries or thinking about all the other things that have to be involved with owning a laser and using a laser. And of course, price too. You know, of course, some models do come equipped with the laser depending on which gun you choose. Then there's also the argument that someone might forget to engage the laser in case of an emergency situation, unless, of course, the laser automatically goes on. Like mine, for instance, on my Springfield Armory XDS, I do have the Crimson Trace laser. And the laser engages as soon as I've got proper grip on the handgun itself. But let's think about some of the advantages of lasers. And talking to the folks at Crimson Trace, it was really awesome to hear their philosophies that, you know, this is for unconventional shooting and unconventional situations. It's not like, oh, I need to learn how to shoot my firearm, so I'm going to put a laser on and just not learn any of the basic fundamentals or mechanics of the gun. That's not what this is all about. Lasers offer quick, easy, and accurate sight alignment on the target, and that's great news for women, for old and young, for experienced and novice shooters alike. In fact, in one of the tests that we did with lasers on firearms, we were shooting a revolver, and we were doing 5 shots at about 15 yards, and we were supposed to place these glasses over our eyes, and the glasses were completely fogged and streaked, and just, you could not see through them, basically. But what was awesome was if I compared my target that I shot with just iron sights versus my target that I shot with the Crimson Trace sights, You could see a huge difference that even in the worst case scenario, again, those unconventional scenarios, I was able to spot the laser and get much better placement on center of mass on that target than I was able to do just alone with the gun and not engaging the laser. So lasers are good for that. They're that little extra added source of, hey, I know exactly where this needs to go. Of course, laser sights are also helpful in those low light conditions and allow the shooter to aim at a target without even having to worry about the iron sights, because it might be impossible to spot that. Lasers can also help you with faster, more accurate follow-up shots. Again, in the heat of the moment, that second shot could be the difference between life and death. And having a laser point the way and kind of be that extra helping hand, if you will, is really important. Plus, I mean, shooters really can sharpen their skills with laser sights because it's great for dry firing. It's great to see how much you might be moving your firearm during shooting. And it can help you with just overall handling and improved shooting skills. So, you know, lasers might not be for everyone, but I just found the whole process and the whole idea to be very, very eye-opening and helpful. So for those who are really looking for that personal protection handgun, for those who are looking for that firearm, that handy, trusty firearm that they can carry with them everywhere, that maybe just has that little bit of an extra sense of security, then I highly recommend a laser. For those who are out shooting competition, well, no, obviously, you know, you're going to want to depend on your skills and the iron sights and lining up properly. But when it all boils down to it, and I'm thinking even of my own mom, I want her to own a firearm. And I'm thinking ease of use across the board. I'm thinking her abilities to handle the gun, manipulate the gun, maintain the gun, clean the gun. But I'm also thinking in the heat of the moment, in that unconventional situation, why would you not want to have that extra support? So there you have it. There's a little bit about lasers, some advantages, perhaps disadvantages, but of course, ultimately the decision going to each shooter for him or herself. That's all I have for this week. Stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felon's behaving badly. Father jailed for shooting at son.
Oh, that's not right.
A 58-year-old Gastonia man was jailed Thursday after police say he shot at his son with a .44 Magnum revolver. Suspect of 3002 Frieda Lane,
stop by and say hi,
came so close to shooting his son, victim, that he put a hole in his shirt, according to an arrest warrant.
Dang.
The shooting occurred at 4:41 p.m. at the home. Suspect was booked into Gaston County Jail under a $15,000 bond on a charge of assault with a deadly weapon.
Yeah, you think?
I would just like to point out that Paul Lathrop had a $25,000 bond reduced from the expected $250,000 bond, and this guy actually shot. They have proof because they had a bullet hole in the guy's shirt. Just wanted to point that out. So, what do you figure? What kind of guy takes a shot at his own son with a .44 Magnum, puts a hole in his shirt? Nice guy, right?
Surely father of the year.
Boy Scout.
Eagle Scout.
Shooting at a Cub Scout.
Clearly, he meant to miss.
Oh, yeah. Working on his pistol merit badge or something.
Absolutely.
Communicating threats, misdemeanor, class 1. Two counts, possess schedule 2, felon, class I. And possession of a firearm by a felon, felon class G. But what about the victim? Resisting officer, misdemeanor class 2. Drug paraphernalia, use possess, misdemeanor class 1. And simple assault affray, misdemeanor class A1.
Yeah. So, not quite like father like son, but not exactly a good role model for the kid either.
No. Apple not falling too far from the tree there. The iPhone 7 has been announced, minus the audio jack, and the world is freaking out. And the Galaxy 7 is catching on fire, and people seem pretty calm about the whole thing. Baron tells us why we've got our priorities backwards in
Tech Tips, Tech Tips, Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Baron.
Well, hey, Baron, what do you got for me this week?
The two big things in the tech world this week is the iPhone 7 is releasing, and the world's coming to an end because the 3.5mm audio jack is going away. The other is that the Galaxy Note 7 is setting the world ablaze, and not because of its wonderful feature set. First, let's start with the iPhone 7. The people who are mainly pissing and moaning about this are largely the people who like to piss and moan. Do I ever use a 3.5mm audio jack? Yes, but rarely am I ever charging my phone while doing it. Actually, here's my approximate usage breakdown. 90% of the time I'm on Bluetooth, 9% of the time I'm mobile mowing my lawn while using the jack, the other 1% I'm sitting at my desk using my noise-canceling headphones and my phone battery is slowly dying. But here's the thing, even on my iPhone 6S, I'm using the docking station's 3.5mm audio jack. It isn't even connected to the phone. So the only pain here is that I have to have a connector they're going to give me with the purchase of the phone. While a little bit inconvenient, it isn't exactly the end of the world, especially since every pair of headphones that uses a cable I own has a separate 3.5mm audio cable. It's completely detachable. I suspect new cables will be coming out with a male 3.5mm audio jack and the lightning connector on the other end. So, now that we've got that crazy insanity out of the way, let's talk about something more, how shall we say, inflammatory. The Galaxy Note 7 and its ability to burn down your SUV. For those who don't know, Samsung is issuing a recall on the batteries in their Note 7 after about 35 of them have spontaneously combusted, including one that burned up a guy's Jeep. It's so bad that the FAA and the European counterparts, the EASA, have issued a warning not to use these devices on airplanes. You can see how bad that could be on an airplane at 30,000 feet, right? So here's a quick primer on lithium batteries, the dangers, and what's going on in the battery. Lithium is a wonderful battery chemistry, due to its lightweight and its ability to supply current over a fairly flat window. Except that window steeply changes past a particular point. With these specifics internal to devices which use lithium, they have a special charging circuit that maintains battery voltage while charging, ensuring a safe rate of charge, and cutting power should the battery voltage decrease past a fail-safe point. That fail-safe point is significant, because if you over-discharge a lithium battery, it can catch fire the next time you try and charge it. Similarly, it can try to catch fire if you charge it too quickly. And lastly, it can catch fire if you overcharge it as well.
I'm seeing a pattern to the way these lithium batteries fail.
That it likes to combust? In the words of Lana Kane, yelp. Due to the chemistry involved, it's fairly unstable, especially since when charging and discharging, heat is produced. That heat can cause thermal runaway, and the chemicals within the battery, especially the lithium, would love to combust. Now, I'm not saying you need to do this for a smartphone, but for those of us who fly RC aircraft, we charge our airplanes' batteries in mini bunkers made out of cinder blocks and ammo cans. We have a lot of respect for lithium batteries. They're scary and well-known for burning down people's houses. But there's a major difference between RC batteries and phone batteries, though. That's the probability of damage. Puncturing a battery is a fast ticket to a fire. RC aircraft are subject to a lot more abuse than your phone. Ever wonder what happens when you puncture a lithium battery? Search YouTube on the subject. It's actually terrifying. Remember, your newest iPhones have about 7 to 10 watts of power depending on the model, and if it starts to fail, it's going to want to release all of that energy at once. That creates a lot of heat, which starts a fire, and bam, you're boned. The big takeaway from all this is to pay attention to your electronics when charging. Try to pay attention to them and not leave them unattended. If they start to get hot, unplug them. If they continue to heat up, put them somewhere away from combustibles. Do not put water on a lithium fire. The best recommended method to extinguish a lithium fire is sand or earth. Toss it outside or put it in your sink and don't turn the water on. While many companies are now trying to rapid charge and the batteries do get hot, it isn't healthy for a lithium battery. Figure out what's normal and acceptable for your phone. As consumers, we definitely shouldn't be accepting of something that is too hot to handle when charging or just after charging. Who wants to grab their phone to leave, toss it in their pocket, and gets burned as it cools down? Remember, also when you get a bleeding edge device, be careful with it at the beginning. When you start fielding a large number of devices, the law of probability starts to come into play. Given the volumes for components and other items, there will be failures. What you don't want is to have one of those failures be discovered in your pocket or as it burns up your Jeep unexpectedly.
What was that old phrase? Never buy version one of anything?
That's right, Sean. When you get the first batch coming off the line, you're beta testing the quality of their mass production. And unless they have a really good QA program and accelerated life screening, you're basically going to be their product tester.
Thanks, Baron. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Barron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
So, in other news, I signed up for Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network because, of course, after listening to Paul Lathrop's wonderful story of exactly what happens to you when you don't even use a firearm to defend yourself, you use the suggestion that you might pull a firearm if somebody doesn't desist from trying to beat your trainee driver. After it cost him tens of thousands of dollars and he said, you know, maybe I should have been part of the ACLDN, I said, you know what? $135 for myself plus another $60 for my wife is really cheap peace of mind. So I spent $195 and became a member of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Well, ACLDN is now a sponsor of the podcast network. So if you decide that you want to be a member of the ACLDN, when you sign up using tracking code 15625. They will give the network a little something for the advertising, and it won't cost you any more. So remember, the tracking code is 15625. And if you can't remember the number, pick up the phone and call them on the phone and just say, hey, look, Paul Lathrop sent me.
This week, Tiffany brings us an interview with Chuck Haggard, police officer and tactical trainer. Tiffany asked Chuck about police community relations on The Bridge.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
I am joined by one of my favorite police officers, whose name is Chuck Haggard. And Chuck, for folks who don't know you, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Chuck. I've been a cop for about pushing 30 years now. Began my career in Topeka, Kansas with the police department there. Did about 28 years, retired. I am a sworn part-time deputy sheriff in a Jackson County, Kansas, north of Topeka, and I'm a full-time police officer slash firefighter slash air crash rescue guy for the airport in Topeka now.
And just for anyone who is not familiar with Chuck Haggard, his introduction at the beginning to simply say, hi, I'm Chuck. That is classic Chuck Haggard, as many of his friends will tell you. Chuck has no idea of his own awesomeness. So he will say things like, oh, I'm just Chuck, nothing to it.
Very kind of you.
Well, it's true. And hopefully I can put a bit of your knowledge on display today with the topic that I wanted to approach with you, which is a delicate one and one that I regret I'm not able to discuss comfortably with many people nowadays. And that is police community relations. The current seeming uptick, and I'm doing my air quotes right now, in police shootings. And I'm going to invite you in a moment to talk about the reality of that seeming uptick, or whether that's a media phenomenon. But I think it's safe to say that there is a great deal of discord, to put it mildly, now in terms of the broader community's relationship with the popo. With that as our backdrop, I'm going to not ask a specific question of you just yet and simply hand you the floor to have you comment in whatever fashion you see fit at the onset. And then if we have time left, maybe we'll go into some specific questions about police community relations. So Chuck Haggard on police community relations, go.
Well, I think cops over the you know, the speaking in general, that they're very poor at PR, or can be very poor at PR, tend to not explain things well, sometimes go into no comment mode because some lawyer tells them, you know, some incidents occurred and we can't police.
Whatever. Damn lawyers.
Yes. Part of the issue is people don't understand is virtually every time I've seen this, you know, CNN started this 24-hour news cycle. People used to turn on the TV, they got news at 5 or news at 6. That was it. CNN starts this 24-hour news cycle. They're in the business of selling commercials. They sell you news so that you can watch commercials. That's what they're in the business of. So they have to grab your attention so that you watch the stuff and you see the commercials and they make money. That's what they're in the business of. They're not in the business of telling you the truth or anything else. They're in the business of making money. So they have to have scoops. They have to scoop each other. They have to put on breaking news. This just happened, yada, yada, yada. initial reports in almost any tense incident. You have a hurricane, you have a tornado, you have a police shooting, whatever the case may be. Initial reports, initial assessments are virtually always incorrect. People under stress are prone to tunnel vision, auditory exclusion, all kinds of things that happen in real life. So part of the things you want to do is when you're reconstructing an incident, you know, a lot of people like to watch CSI, look at the forensics. Well, I'm going to give people a clue. You can't take a swab, walk across to a machine in a lab, drop it in, and have DNA analysis in like 30 seconds. That's science fiction. That type of DNA analysis is as realistic as, you know, spaceships and lightsabers. It just doesn't exist. Part of the news cycle, I think, has given us a perception of what reality really is, and it's not reality. I talk to people all the time under something a little less combative, if you will. People for the past 10 years that I talk to on the street are under the impression that crime is at an all-time high, murders, violent crime, things like that. And when I explain to them, if you look at national statistics, that crime is not only low, it's lower than it's almost ever been. That crime over the past few years has been at levels like Mayberry, RFD, Leave It to Beaver days. We have not in our lifetimes seen crime this low. They're stunned, but, you know, I see this on the news all the time. That's your perception of what it is. It's not the reality of what's really going on. Police shootings are a part of that. There's no big uptick in police shootings. There's a big uptick in the reporting of police shootings. If you look at a historical statistical analysis of things that can kill you, your odds of being shot dead by the police are about equal statistically as the odds of being struck dead by lightning. It's simple math. And that disregards the fact that there are a number of people who need to be shot by the police. Take a non-controversial one, the active shooter in the gay club down in Orlando. SWAT team comes in, they end up shooting that guy. You didn't see any protests over that. That guy needed to be shot as quickly as possible. So some of those police shootings are going to be legitimate. It's just a fact of life. So what we're really talking about is an issue with a perception that illegitimate or incorrect police shootings are happening.
When we have these giant wedges between these two communities, when you have, and of course the mother of all cases, at least in recent years, is Trayvon Martin, and how that just tore right through. You know, there are folks on total polar opposites of the fence on that. And then you had the facts kind of somewhere in the middle. What do you think accounts for that? How is it that seemingly well-meaning people can, on the one hand, take the exact same set of facts and view the police as racist murderers, and an equally well-meaning set of folks can just as easily take that same set of facts and see thuggish kid or, you know, ghetto family, doesn't understand police? You know, how are we missing each other so drastically?
Well, I think it's a horrible part of human nature that we tend to, you look at historically, we were prone to burning of witches. The famous Monty Python skit in the Holy Grail movie, going to burn the witch, burn the witch, burn the witch. And the knight is asking him, well, you know, what happened? She turned me into a newt. A newt? Well, I got better. Really? It's human nature to want to burn witches. It is a ugly part of human nature that we have not progressed past that tendency. People think that we are so modern and well-developed because we have cell phones that are actually computers that have more computing power than an IBM computer in the 50s that took up an entire building. You know, we're so advanced. We're really not. Emotionally, logically speaking, things like that, we're not. It's a human tendency to burn the witch and to fly off the handle. I am disturbed by, I'm not even sure how to word it. It's going to be controversial regardless. I see people engaging in behavior that is falling towards a spectrum of lynch mobbery, and seeing that come from African-American culture, which has been the traditional victims in the past of lynching, is something I find very disturbing. the fact that people can complain about racism and discrimination and then take an entire profession of people. I've worked with police officers. They're short, they're tall, they're male, they're female, Hispanic, white, black, American Indian, Asian, people born in this country, people not born in this country, people who were atheists, people who were Christians, a gentleman that was a Sikh, a gentleman, several guys that I know that are Muslim. I've worked with all of these people. I used to point out to people that one of my officers who worked for me on my squad was female. She was Mexican. She was a lesbian and she was an atheist. So do you think that she is exactly the same as, maybe another officer I had on my squad that was a football player, a white guy from Nebraska? The idea that all cops are XYZ is patently ludicrous. And it should occur to people who are screaming about discrimination and racism and other isms that they are applying exactly the same ugly train of thought to an entire profession of people who are actually a very diverse group of people.
I know a lot of folks in African-American culture who are, I'm going to grossly overgeneralize this, but who are, just to give them the convenient label, anti-cop. But they don't think of themselves as part of the problematic trend that you just described. And they preface their every complaint with, I know all cops aren't bad, or most cops are good people. It's almost as if by prefacing your complaint with that, you're not a copist, if you will. That you're.
If I turn that language around and I said, I know that not all young men, black men, are drug dealers, but how would that be taken?
So how would you, as a law enforcement officer and as a person, and I'm gonna take a bit of personal privilege here and say to confirm what you just said a moment ago, which is that I happen to know that you work with all kinds of stripes, all different types of folks. What advice would you give to non-police? And, we tend to focus on the African-American community, black folks, but it's not just black folks. It's a lot of liberal, progressive, young, professional, white, suburban folks who are equally anti-cop.
I can tell you early in my, I was a high school kid. The local cops in the town where I lived, I didn't like them, didn't have a lot of respect for them. I can look back and say that they were very poorly trained. They applied poor policing methods, and in fact, some of the stuff they did was unconstitutional. I was once walking to Hardee's on a lunch break with another kid, and I owed him some money, and we were going to lunch, and he bought fries last time, so we stopped in the parking lot, and I handed him some money. Cop was driving by, saw it, because we both had long hair. He knew it was a drug deal. And we were thrown against the car, and we were searched, and he dug into our pockets. And so it was way beyond a Terry stop. And, he physically searched us without probable cause or a warrant, something I know now to be an unconstitutional. The stop was unconstitutional. The search was unconstitutional. He violated my civil rights. Very, very angry about all that. And it was all because I had long hair. And, long-haired people do drugs. So, that was his way of thinking. I was very anti-police for quite some time. It was through exposure to one of my best friend's dads, who was a career highway patrolman, a salt-of-the-earth guy, one of the finest human beings I've ever met, that I realized, that, maybe not all cops are bad. And once that camel's nose is under the door, then you have to start to look at, I took some introspection to realize that maybe I need to think about this a little bit. Knowing then what I know now, did that small town department have poor hiring practices and really crappy training? Yeah, it did. Nowadays, when I ask people, if you're unhappy with your police department, have you ever, because we know in modern policing, when they take a budget hit, the first thing that gets chopped is training. Have you ever lobbied your local elected officials to increase the training budget and resources for your police department to try and fix that problem? And to date, I have never had anyone ever say, yes, I have. They just give me that look like, oh, wow, it's like really never occurred to me that that's something I should advocate for.
You actually read my mind a little bit. That was the question I was getting to, which is to say, what advice would you have to folks who are against the police or who have harbored disdain for their local police department? And so that would be one, to advocate with local governing bodies for more training dollars.
I tell people all the time, you get the police department you vote for. People look at me funny. Well, like my old police chief, he didn't get to pick manning levels. He didn't get to pick his budget. He would advocate for things, and then the mayor and the city council would allocate those resources. You get the police department you vote for. So if you don't like your police department, you are partially to blame because you helped elect the wrong people. That's the way it works. And with the sheriff's department, it's even simpler. If you don't like your sheriff's department, you helped, you know, maybe you voted for the other guy, but the elected body as a whole, or the electing, you know, the population as a whole, elected that sheriff. He's an elected official that's accountable to the population. If you don't like the sheriff's department you have, there's recourses to take. Truly, I see, like, you know, I'll pick on Chicago because they've had problems for decades. They don't make training a priority. I don't know if people are aware, but they might be shocked to find out that outside of yearly qualification, once a year with their handguns, the Chicago Police Department, after the academy, has no mandatory in-service training whatsoever. So you could be a police officer for 20 or 30 years and never go through updated training a single time in your career. When I tell people that, they're stunned. Well, whose fault is that? I'm not totally familiar with the government. I know Chicago has a mayor because their mayor is always high profile, but they have some sort of city council or governing body that, you know, if they were to go to the police chief of Chicago PD and tell him, you know what, this is unacceptable, we're going to hold you accountable, we want this training thing taken care of, I guarantee you training would start the next day, or they would have a new police chief. But does anybody advocate towards our elected officials in Chicago? You know what? We find it unacceptable in modern society that our police officers aren't required to go through updated training. Just one example, kind of a glaring example. But
well, I'm way over my time, and I know that Sean is going to hate me for once again doing an 8-minute interview in about, 22 minutes. But yeah. I have to get in one last question, and it's actually the exact opposite of the question we were just discussing. That's the advice that you have for the communities. What advice do you have for the cops? Would you say to the police who are pissed off that they're not appreciated, they hate the neighborhoods where they serve, or they're sick of people accusing them of being murderers or racist, the morale is down, they're quick to defend almost any police action, what advice would you give to law enforcement in the wake of current events?
Be as professional as possible. Your department does not love you. They do not actually care about you. The job will never love you. You can love the job, it won't love you. If they don't get you the training, get the training yourself. I used to see guys complain about how much a training class cost, and then they go turn around and buy a set of golf clubs or whatever. Be professional. Know the Constitution. Take your job and your profession very seriously. You can be a squared away, tactically adept, high-speed shooter, weightlifting god, defensive tactics guy, and you don't have to be an asshole to people. You can do all the above. Don't be a stereotype. Get out and meet people. Talk to people. Talk to people at a human level. Know the Constitution. Do the job exactly the way it's supposed to be done. Be by the book. And that would go a long way. If you're doing the right thing at the right time, not only look right, you know, not only be right, but look right, it will go a long way to solving the problem. Leadership, most of the failures that I see in police departments are a failure in leadership, and they're a failure in courage, and they're a failure in professionalism at the top levels. There's the old, like Michael Jackson song, and talk about the man in the mirror and stuff like that. Police chiefs, police and sheriffs and police officers need to be the lack of bullshit they wish to see in society.
On that note, I will end my 8-minute interview. Chuck, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I hope I can talk you into doing another interview maybe sometime soon.
Would love to.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
So, Sean, you are totally to blame for today's segment.
Oh, really?
You see, earlier I posted to the Blue Collar Prepping Facebook group that I had no idea what I was going to talk about and that I wondered what I was going to figuratively pull out of my butt. And then you replied with...
Keister Carry! That's this week's segment on Blue Collar Prepping on the Gun Blog Variety Cast.
Right. And so help me, because my brain is wired inappropriately, I started to think about what kinds of things preppers could put up their recta. Now, before you think I'm being rude or gross or R-rated here, this is not going to be a collection of dirty jokes or references to Pulp Fiction or anything like that. Instead, I'm going to talk about the Murphy drip, which is a method of rehydration using the large intestine.
You know, if you can't be bothered to just drink the water, you're going to die.
So you're being flippant, but there is a kernel of truth to that. If you stay properly hydrated, you won't need to do this. However, there are instances where someone isn't going to be able to drink water. Maybe they're sick and they're throwing everything up. Maybe they have an injury to their mouth, jaw, or throat. Or maybe there's no uncontaminated fresh water to be found. The fact remains that the large intestine's main purpose is to remove water from food waste before our body expels it. And that means it's great at absorbing water, even if that water comes from the wrong way. And because the large intestine is adapted to feces, it's uniquely adapted for separating the good stuff, water, from the bad stuff, other forms of contamination. So if you have water that is brackish or unpurified, this is a way to rehydrate yourself or another when you don't have access to clean water or if someone is sick. In many ways, I would say that the Murphy drip is superior to an IV because you need training to use IVs, and even then, it can be hard to find a vein of someone who is dehydrated. And of course, there's always the danger of bloodborne pathogens. With a Murphy drip, there's no need to worry about not being able to hit your target, and you don't need a specialized kit. In fact, all you need is a water reservoir like a Camelback, a length of tube, some tape, something to cut with, something to clamp with, and Vaseline. Now, Vaseline is something every prepper ought to have in their kits anyway, as it has a variety of uses. You can use it as fuel for fires, since it's petroleum-based, and you can put it over blisters to protect them and over wounds to keep bacteria out. So, here's how you make and apply a field expedient Murphy drip. First, warm the water if possible to prevent an unpleasant shock. And this can be done by heating water and then pouring it in, or just holding the reservoir against the body to warm it via body temperature. But don't let it get too hot. Keep it close to 100 degrees or so. However, if the victim is unconscious or severely dehydrated, this step can be skipped. Next, attach the tubing to the reservoir. If you're using a hydration bladder, use the victim's and not your own. Then attach your clamp near the reservoir into the tube. Something like a clothespin will work, but in a pinch, anything that restricts the flow of water to a trickle will do, such as a length of paracord tied in a constrictor knot. But make sure that it isn't so tight that it cuts off all flow. Then cut the other end of the tubing at an angle to facilitate insertion. If you are using stiff tubing, like with a Camelback, you might find it necessary to soften any sharp edges by running an open flame over it to melt it slightly. Measure 4 to 8 inches, and this is based on the size of the victim, from the tip, and mark that point preferably with tape. This is the point beyond which you will not insert the tube. Next, if the patient is conscious, have them remove their clothing below the waist and lie on their left side. If they're unconscious, you're going to have to do this yourself. Then wash your hands and put on surgical gloves if possible. Apply a thin coat of Vaseline to the tube and insert it slowly and gently into the patient's rectum. Do not insert it past the taped point, and stop if the patient expresses more than the usual discomfort of something being inserted up their rectum. The last thing you want in this scenario is a perforated colon. Then tape the tube to the patient's buttocks, and then tape the buttocks together. This will prevent the tube from being expelled and will prevent fluid loss. Then adjust the clamp to ensure a slow trickle of water down the tube. Wrap the reservoir in clothing to insulate it so that it doesn't get cold. And then finally, hang the reservoir or have someone hold it. And if this isn't possible, just lay it on the patient's right side.
So why the clamp, Aaron? Don't we want to get fluid into someone as quickly as possible?
Well, in the case of severe, the patient is going to die right now, dehydration, then yes. And that technique is also a good way to treat someone with hypothermia. By inserting warm water into the colon of a hypothermic, it's a good way to quickly warm up their core. But you want to restrict the flow in normal situations because a rapid flow of water to the colon turns this into an enema. And you should know what happens as a result of an enema, right? We want to keep water inside the body, not expelled as part of a bowel movement. Of course, if someone is constipated out in the field or after a disaster, this might be necessary. Regardless, keep some towels handy. And finally, some words of warning when using the Murphy drip. This does not allow the body to consume salt water, so don't do it. Putting seawater up your colon is actually a worse idea than drinking it. Do not force water into the patient's colon by squeezing. This will result in the aforementioned mess and extreme discomfort on the part of the patient. The flow must not be greater than a simple gravity feed. If you are doing a full enema rather than a drip, make sure all of the air is out of the tube before insertion. Keep your finger over the tube tip until the moment of insertion to prevent an air bubble. Medication can be absorbed through the intestine along with the water, but be careful if you aren't a trained professional. Given how quickly the intestine absorbs water, this can result in an overdose if extreme care is not taken. Unless you are trained, do not do this unless it's an emergency. And finally, if you are using the poor sod's camelback, be sure to cut the tube past the insertion point and clean it thoroughly before reapplying the bite valve. If this isn't a good motivation for you to keep spare tubes in your kits, I don't know what is.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. This week, Weird tackles a stalking horse for gun control. Mike, the so-called gun guy, Weiser. In This week in anti-gun nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
As you probably know, I spend a lot of time reading anti-gun blogs and anti-gun articles. One character I get asked about a lot, but rarely cover, is a gentleman from Massachusetts named Mike Weiser. See, Mike is an NRA life member, NRA instructor, and the owner of the Ware Gun Shop in Ware, Massachusetts. Mike is also a hardline Democrat and an unapologetic bootlicker for Hillary Clinton and Michael Bloomberg. He is also the founder of the National Medical Council on Gun Violence, which is an extremely obscure group founded for the sole reason to get more medical professionals to support the anti-gun agenda. Really, he's never met a gun control law that he thought went too far. And he is the added bonus, if you read his blog and Huffington Post articles, of not much caring for women or minorities, leading to amusing flame war between him and Collier Noir. But really, I don't want to cover him because at best, he's a C-lister. Yeah, he's the head of an anti-gun political action group, but it's one I honestly had never heard of, and I look pretty hard for this kind of stuff. And when it comes to his work for the Clinton and Bloomberg assault on the Second Amendment, he's just a simple volunteer. Still, he's pushing his brand pretty hard, and oh boy, do the anti-gunners love gun owners, police, or military members who want to ban guns for that great appeal to authority fallacy. So he gets a lot more ears than he deserves. I found this interview on Boston Public Radio. Mike first fields a question on why the NRA is so popular.
The NRA is very skillful in making people feel that because you own a gun, you are special, you are different from people who don't, and therefore you really need to be with other gun owners. The problem, you know, again, with other advocacy organizations is because they kind of appeal to everybody. You don't made, you know, you're not made to feel that special. I mean, who's going to argue with a tree? Nobody.
I really don't see this with the NRA. First up, I actually know many people who are NRA members or NRA supporters who don't own guns. Hell, I considered joining before I bought my first gun, but I really didn't have the disposable income at the time. And when I got disposable income, I bought guns and joined the NRA. Second, it's not that gun owners are special or unique, it's that the Second Amendment is special, as it's the one amendment that protects them all. There was a bad joke I once heard. If you had to choose between the First and Second Amendment, what would you choose? Well, I'd choose the Second, and then say whatever I wanted, because I had a gun. It's a little over the top, but wiser men than myself always said, anti-gun politicians want to ban guns because they want to do things to us that an armed society simply wouldn't tolerate.
When I joined the organization, I joined it when I was 11 years old in 1955 because I was a member of a shooting club that practiced at my brother's junior high school in the basement of McFarland Junior High in Washington, D.C. They had a shooting range. It was not unusual. And at that time, really, the NRA fundamentally represented gun owners who were sportsmen and hunters, because that's why people own guns. And what began to happen in the 1980s is that sportsmen and much more hunters simply began to disappear because it's a type of a hobby that just, you know, kind of no longer worked.
Ah, the old Elmer Fudd angle. Again, George Washington didn't cross the Delaware to get to his duck blind. The Founding Fathers never considered sport hunting when they wrote the Second Amendment. Back in those days, there really wasn't such a thing as recreational hunting. Shooting ducks and deer was really just a 19th century grocery store. And I'd be willing to bet if you put a Kroger in a time machine, there wouldn't be many Revolutionary War vets who would choose getting muddy in the moors or going out to the glades to put meat in the pot when there was a butcher's counter in the town square. The anti-gunners love people like Mike because he makes appeals to the weakest arguments for gun ownership. You like to shoot ducks and deer to put meat in your freezer? Well, you can also fill your freezer with bargains at your local Safeway. You like target shooting? Well, guns are dangerous. Maybe you should just take up golf.
The idea that everybody should, you know, go out, buy a gun, go to the range, shoot a couple hundred rounds, then become the good guy who's going to patrol the neighborhood. Let me tell you something. The last person who patrolled a neighborhood like that was a gentleman in Florida named George Zimmerman.
See what he did there? He attempted to belittle the real argument for gun ownership. Go read The Armed Citizen, published by the NRA, or any other defensive gun use aggregate. You will quite often see people who have done just that. They bought a gun, often not even a high-quality gun, got minimal, if any, training, and oh my, successfully defended their lives from a violent attacker. He closes with an appeal to emotion by bringing up George Zimmerman's name, and only his name, because the name George Zimmerman invokes a reaction because he's a flawed man with a lot of media drama. But like him or not, he was assaulted violently and suffered serious injury at the hands of Trayvon Martin, who was also not a reputable man. And had George not been armed that night, he probably would have been murdered. See, gun banners hate self-defense because they can't argue with it. Remember, George Zimmerman called the police before he stepped out of his car. And still they didn't arrive until after Martin was dead. When seconds count, police are minutes away. There's nothing an anti-gunner can say to deny that.
And they went really focused on this whole issue of using guns for self-defense, a little bit because of the fact that long guns, other than assault rifles, weren't selling. And actually, assault rifles weren't really being made until the mid-90s.
Now, this is really a statement that's indicative of Mike's writing and interviews. He is, in fact, a real gun shop owner and firearms instructor, not some false flag, yet he constantly makes these sloppy factual errors. So first, yeah, he's interchanging assault rifle with assault weapon. That's sloppy and he should know better, but it's pedantic. But his implications that modern semi-auto rifles weren't being made until the mid-90s? Well, we know when modern sporting rifles were being made. Most of them got their start in the 50s and 60s. And even if I was to be very charitable and claim that guns like the AR-15, while being made in the 1950s, weren't being sold in any real numbers before the mid-90s, even though he said nothing of the sort, if that was true, why did George H.W. Bush sign an executive order banning the import of so-called assault weapons in the late 80s?
And also because it was a quick and easy way to respond to what they saw as a growing concern on the part of a certain segment of the population, fear of crime, fear of just not wanting to trust the government to protect them.
And that was born of both Rodney King and then subsequently that white truck driver that was pulled out of the cab of his truck. Was that the genesis of the new focus?
Another winner of the No Shit Sherlock Award. Holy crap, the LA riots were shown live around the clock, and you got to see that when things go pear-shaped, the police aren't around to help you.
You are on your own.
The police didn't save Reginald Denny, the truck driver who was beaten within an inch of his life on national TV. And riots happen all the time. And recently, the police couldn't save the people victimized by the riots, plural, in Ferguson and Baltimore either. But we did see something else in the 24-hour coverage of the LA riots. the Korean shopkeepers who successfully protected their stores and neighborhoods from the ubiquitous looters. I find it hard to believe that anybody, after watching that bedlam and the relative calm of Koreatown, would not want to get a firearm. I wonder what Mike's excuse is.
Are you this hated, treasonous NRA member, or?
Well, let's put it this way. I certainly have never, I've had a few comments made about things I've said on various NRA blogs, but, you know, I expect them to do that, and all it really does is drives the readership on my own website and on Huffington. I do get a significant amount of, you know, kind of angry, threatening emails.
To make you nervous?
No, not at all. My suspicion is that most of these people are either kids or angry, pissed off older men who have nothing else that they can do except sit around the computer and send out profane and angry messages.
Now we get to the juicy stuff. So had this been said by any other anti-gun nut, I might have taken him at their word. You see, anti-gunners, by their nature, push laws and regulations that punish lawful gun owners for the actions of criminal lowlifes who don't follow any laws. If that doesn't piss you off, nothing will. Still, the appropriate response is not to resort to angry name-calling, but to take a deep breath, collect yourself, and rebut the argument in a calm and respectful manner. I would assume that some people do the former rather than the latter, and most anti-gunners fixate on this behavior to play the martyr card. Only this is Mike Weiser speaking. See, when I discovered Mike's blog, I started writing respectful comments that challenged his and his readers' anti-gun views. I logged them all in my blog, which I've linked in the show notes. I'll share with you my first interaction with Mike Weiser. He sent me this email. Note, this is the first response I got from him directly, ever. I quote, "Why don't you go fuck yourself, okay? Happy? I used to be somewhat polite and responding to jerk-offs like you, and would disregard not only your utter stupidity, but the endless insulting language." What a charmer, huh? When that's what he uses as a greeting, well, to quote the bard, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks."
If they buy a gun, they buy it strictly on impulse because they happen to be in a shop. They got a couple hundred bucks in their pocket that the old lady doesn't know about. And you know what? I'm going to go buy a gun. And that's the reason why people buy guns. Now, if you sit one of these guys down and you buy him lunch and you talk to him for a half an hour or so and you get into all kinds of things about the Second Amendment and blah, 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 he'll tell you more or less what he's heard from somebody else, because the last thing he wants to admit is that he just plunked $500 down for no reason at all. But the truth is, it's pure impulse.
Is this true for anybody? Hey, Sean, you just bought a new SIG. Was that an impulse buy?
Absolutely. Every single payday, I went in on impulse and made a payment until it was mine.
How about that Ruger American you keep pining over?
Only the fact that my bank account does not have enough impulse to support another gun this year is stopping me.
I have a pretty big collection, and some of my guns I bought completely unplanned, but every last one I've bought for a solid reason. They're too expensive to buy on complete impulse. Still, his whole statement about sitting the guy down and buying him lunch is likely a bald-faced lie, given this charming man uses "go fuck yourself" in lieu of a handshake. Mike is really a small-minded, repugnant individual. Hopefully we won't see much more of him. But sadly, I doubt that.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week, the Gun Rights Policy Conference and the Gun Rights Policy Conference live stream. Now, we told you at the top of the show, get out your pen and paper, get ready to copy so you can watch the live stream. Now, some of you are going to want to watch the live stream because you have some interest in seeing me embarrassed with my pony shirts, but the vast majority of you want to watch the live stream because there are some fantastic speakers who are going to be speaking on a huge variety of topics, all of interest to you. So those of you who want to see that want to go to politicsandguns.com/live, L-I-V-E. That's politicsandguns/live. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode 109.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.